So this is the beginning of the first broadcast, the Radio Free Erica from Basin, Montana. And that was Kate Bush singing Big Sky, which seemed appropriate. Today is the jazz brunch benefit for the Montana Artist Refuge. And there's some music happening a couple doors down, and there's open studios. A gallery exhibition downstairs. It's so far not rainy. We've had a few days of pouring rain. Would you guys like to talk on the radio a little bit? Talk about coming to... Sure, it's on the internet and nobody's listening right now. So I can...
We're just fortunate to have reached good weather.
Yes. This is on now. So, what brings you to Basin?
We came to support the refuge.
That's great. And what's your connection to the refuge?
We know the people who started it.
Uh-huh. Are you guys local in Basin?
Or
Helena. Helena.
Art.
Yeah, have you been coming? So you've seen it grow and change? And
I haven't actually been here before last year. That was my first year.
Uh-huh.
But I am friends with the people who started it and have been with it since it started.
And it seems like an amazing group.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Those, what do you call them, lenticular
prints? Oh, thank you. Yeah, the three on the left are in progress, and the one on the right is a final print. So that's what the size they all look, and thanks. They're fun.
They're wonderful. Have fun.
Okay, thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Enjoy the day. So it took us 5 days to drive here from Brooklyn, and here comes Dove and Mark. Maybe Dove can tell a little bit about. Oh, you want a cookie? You want to come up and talk about our trip out here in the car? Into the microphone?
No.
No, on the radio?
What's the sign
say? The sign says that this is a radio broadcast. It took us 5 days to get here in the car, and we saw 5 swimming pools along the way. Dove, you want to talk about the swimming pools?
I'll get you a cookie and you can talk to Mom. Okay? Sure, see this.
No, it doesn't come out. Here, now it's pointed right at you.
You hold it?
Nope.
Why?
You need to hold it. Now we can hear really well. Do you want to listen?
But I want to hold it.
Here, listen.
No.
Okay.
Do you hear me talking?
Yeah.
Yes? So, you want to talk in and tell about the drive? What did you like seeing on the drive? And
pool.
You like the swimming pools?
Yeah.
And what did you do in the swimming pools?
I swam in them.
You swam in them?
Yes.
And then what else did we do on the drive?
Well, I have a cookie.
Excellent. What animals did...
I like a necklace.
Thank you. You gave it to me. Do you remember the animals we saw on the drive?
No.
Town. We saw the whole town.
A prairie dog town.
Mm-hmm.
And the buffalo town.
Oh, and the buffalo town too, yeah.
And a bison town.
Mm-hmm.
And a mommy town.
What did you do in the car when we were driving?
I told Daddy and Mommy that I wanted to read a book in the car. And Daddy says, he needs to lie down a little bit. And it took a long drive to go here.
It didn't take a long drive to get here.
Why?
Oh, because it's very far. It's, I think 2,300 something miles.
Wow, that's a long way.
Yeah, from Avenue K. It's a long way.
Very far away.
Very far away.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing since we came to Montana? Oh, don't touch that, please.
Why?
Because it's going to fall down.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Yeah.
So can you talk about what we've been doing, or what you've been doing since you've been here?
There's going to be an art party.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to... eat a cookie. And soon when I'm done with the microphone, I'm going to eat my cookie.
Okay, no more uh-oh.
Why?
There we go. So as soon as you're done with the microphone, you're going to eat your cookie. But what have you been doing all the days since we've been here? We've been here.
I'm going to dance on the stage to show them my dance.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to eat my cookie.
You're going to eat your cookie?
And then I'm going to sweep and sweep and sweep and sweep and sweep.
Mm-hmm.
And sweep 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 and sweep.
Great. What have you and Daddy done?
I'm going to sleep all the time.
That's a lot of sleeping. Montana's good for sleeping, huh?
Why?
And it's cool at night, and our room is nice and dark.
And what?
Debbie, what have you and Daddy been doing while Mommy works in the studio?
I've been brushing my teeth and scooting.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a man who wanted to play hockey.
Mm-hmm.
With a hockey stick like you. Swish, swish. And it hurts people.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
But was he hurting people with it?
No.
No.
He was just wanted to ask me that he hurts people.
Mm.
But he didn't hurt me.
Yeah. He was just telling you to be careful.
Yeah.
What new things have you learned in Montana?
I learned to talk on the microphone.
Yeah, you did. That is new. What other new things have you learned?
I'm done talking with the microphone.
Okay, do you want to tell me just about fishing first?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Hi. Hi. Come on in. We're doing an internet radio broadcast. If you'd like to sit down, he's almost finished, he said.
That's okay.
Have a look around, and I'll ask you.
For art.
Oh, yeah, the kitchen. Yeah. It's confusing layout. So, Debbie, tell me about fishing.
Fishing is a fun game.
It's a fun game.
Yeah. And I know that I'm gonna have a cookie.
Okay.
Gee.
What kind of fish have you fished for so far?
Trout and fishies.
Trout and fishies.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for talking with me on the radio.
There's cookies on that table.
There are cookies on that table, but yeah. You have one on your table right here.
She has one.
Great. So that was Dove. He's 3 years old, and he's traveled to Montana with me, and he brought his little house, and he's been sleeping, and he learned how to fish since he's been here fly fishing. He's really good at it.
Why?
He's been practicing. So we didn't let her sit down, so we can ask her some questions. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
He looks like he's having a great time.
Yeah.
Are you having fun?
Yeah.
Are you going to be on? You're going to be on radio. You are on radio.
What brings you to the benefit today?
I was from Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And,
turn that on.
I moved to Helena. And I happened to see in the paper, it's all over in Helena. Artists performed in the jazz festivals here. So that's why I came. I just wanted to experience it, see what it was like.
Oh, that's great. You're the first person who's come through that hasn't known somebody specifically. That's nice to hear that there is, like, it's around.
Okay, because it's like in Helena. They were giving out brochures, and it was in the newspaper and everything. So.
Great.
Yeah.
Have you...
This little town, too. It's very cute.
It is really cute. It's really nice. Have you had your brunch sitting yet?
No, I didn't go to that.
Okay.
So where is this broadcast to?
This broadcast is live on the internet, and that's the web address there.
Big chair.
So are you going to let her sit down? Here, you can take your cookie, and we'll get you a tall chair.
Chair.
Yes. Are you also an artist?
Yeah. I do artwork. I do drawings, I do photography, and I do poetry.
Okay.
And I work with yarn and knit too. But that's just for fun. Well, all of it's for fun.
It sounds familiar.
And I inquired about possibly displaying some of my stuff here next week.
Oh, great. You talked to Joy? Or
they gave me some brochures and everything.
Oh, great.
To call, you know, and I guess there's going to be another art thing in Helena. I think 22nd or something like that.
Great.
So, but I'll wait till next year because I have to put my stuff together and everything.
Yeah, she shows work down the street also in the Big Sky Cafe. She has nice work hanging up there too, Montana artist. So how long have you been in Montana?
Since day 17.
Oh, wow. This is a little longer than us. Well, no, we came June 1st, so.
Where are you from?
From Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so we're just here for the month in the residency and then we'll
go
back. Yeah, but you are here.
I'm here and staying.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah,
that's true. It was an interesting trip. I drove all the way.
Yeah.
Are we going to another hotel?
Yes, on the way back, we'll go to another hotel. I bet you stayed in some hotels too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it rained most of the time.
Oh, driving.
Yeah, until I got to North Dakota, like to Fargo, and then it stopped.
Oh, you went further north than we did.
I went through Chicago, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, and then Montana.
Oh, great.
If you ever get a chance, have you been to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho?
No. Coeur d'Alene?
Yeah, it's 5 hours from off of 90 West. You go 90 West. It's beautiful. I mean, this is beautiful here too, but it's incredible. Coeur d'Alene Lake is one of the 5 most beautiful lakes in the world.
Wow. The name is familiar, but I haven't been there.
Everybody says, oh, why would you want to go to Coeur d'Alene? There's just potatoes there in Idaho.
Uh-huh.
I said, no, it's beautiful. There's mountains and beautiful lakes.
They're also so known for their winter sports.
Oh, yeah. They get a lot of snow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what brought you here?
I have friends that live in Montana. And I decided that, you know, I mean, because I used to live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which gets 300 inches of snow a year.
300?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness.
In a little town with 1,700 people.
Wow. 300.
That was interesting. That was scary.
And how long were you there?
About 4 years.
Wow.
And then I moved downstate Michigan, and the people aren't as friendly there. Unfortunately, they are becoming more friendly, but people here are very friendly.
Yeah, everybody's been really friendly.
Yeah, I wave to everybody, you know, I mean, that's just how I am, and I think, what does it hurt to be friendly?
Yeah, it's amazing. We just learned yesterday that the state has only 900,000 people in it, and we live in Brooklyn. I'm not sure how many people are in the borough of Brooklyn, but, you know, New York City is 10 million.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right.
Okay, why don't you ask Daddy to close it for you? Could you close that window for him? Yeah, there's a screen. Yeah.
So when do you go back?
We go back at the end of the month. We're here for a month.
Are you sad to go back? Or are you happy?
Well, I don't know. It's far enough away yet that I haven't thought about it too much. But probably both. It's sad more that it gives us this time to all of us be together and make art
Yeah, it's different. It's a slower pace.
Yeah.
Than it is, you know, because I live in city for a very fast pace, and I live in a slower pace. I'm not hustling to go it somewhere else.
Yeah. I feel like New Yorkers are masters at, like, you go out and it's crazy, but you come in and creating, like, quiet, real quiet, and
yeah.
I like the energy of the city. I feel like it's really feeding in a way. I like riding the bus and hearing 5 different languages and
yeah, I understand that.
Yeah,
where there's more diversity.
Yeah,
I'm surprised that there is more. There is somewhat diversity in Helena, I think, but not as much as like in Michigan. You have a lot more diversity there, mm-hmm. and like you say, in the big cities.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, good luck, and I wish you that. Are you driving back or you fly back?
We'll drive back.
Well, I wish you a safe journey.
Thank you. What's your name?
My name is Linda.
Linda. Okay, Linda, this will be archived and up on the website that's down below there if you want to listen. To yourself later. Okay. Thanks a lot. Good to meet you. Hi. We're broadcasting live on the internet. If you'd like to sit down and talk about what brings you here, or you can just look around. So, I have some other Montana facts that I've been keeping here. Basin is listed with a population of 255, but through anecdotes, it seems that there's probably closer to 300 people in the town. And Basin is halfway between Butte and Helena, off of the Interstate 15. It is 5,300 feet high. And Montana, which I feel a little silly that I didn't know this before, but Montana translates to mountains, and because it's a very mountainous state, it has more mountains than any other state. And for Wade, he had asked if there's a speed limit. Yes, there is now. It seems that changed somewhere in the mid-90s. There's a speed limit of 75 miles per hour on the major highways. Another recent change in relation to driving is a closed container law, which I thought you would appreciate too. I wanted to read. A story. Called The Boots of Buffalo Leather, and it's not it's a story, and I can't remember if it's both the Brothers Grimm's or just one, so it's not a local story or anything, but it does have some local resources in terms of buffalo leather. So, this is The Boots of Buffalo Leather. A soldier who fears nothing will let nothing stand in his way. There was once such a soldier who had received his discharge, and since he had never learned a craft and could not earn anything, he wandered about and asked for charity from kind people. An old cape hung from his shoulders, and he still wore a pair of riding boots made out of buffalo leather. One day he went deep into the fields without regard to the way he took, and finally he found himself in the forest.
He had no idea where he was, but he saw a man sitting on the trunk of a tree that had been chopped down. This man was very well dressed and wore a huntsman's coat. The soldier shook his hand, sat down next to him on the grass, and stretched his legs. "I see you're wearing fine, sparkling boots," the soldier said, "but if you were forced to wander about as much as I do, they would not last long. Look at mine. They're made out of buffalo leather and have served me well through thick and thin." After a while, the soldier stood up and said, "I can't stay here any longer. My stomach is grumbling. So, Brother Sparkle Boots, tell me the way out of the forest." "I don't know myself," the huntsman answered. "I've lost my way." "So you are in the same boat as me," the soldier said. "Birds of a feather flock together. Let's stick together and look for the way out." The huntsman smiled slightly, and together they moved on until it became dusk. "We've not found the way out of the woods," the soldier said, "but I see a light glimmering in the distance. We will find something to eat there." They came upon an old stone house and knocked at the door, and an old woman opened it. "We're looking for a night's lodging," the soldier said, "and something to line our stomach. Mine is as empty as an old satchel." "You cannot stay here," the old woman answered. "The house belongs to robbers, and you'd be smart to get along before they return home, because you will be goners if they find you here." "It won't be that bad," the soldier replied. "I haven't had a thing to eat for 2 days, and I don't care whether I die here or die from starvation in the forest. I'm going inside." The huntsman did not want to follow, but the soldier tugged him by the sleeve. "Come, old bunny, it won't cost you your life right away." The old woman took pity on them and said, "Crawl behind the stove. I'll sneak you some of the leftovers after the robbers have fallen asleep." The soldier and the huntsman had barely found their hiding place when 12 robbers stormed inside, sat down at the table that was already set, and boisterously demanded their dinner. The old woman carried out a large piece of meat to the table, and the robbers began to devour it with gusto. As the smell of the meat reached the soldier's nose, he said to the huntsman, "I cannot hold out anymore. I'm going to join them and eat my share." "You will be the death of us," the huntsman replied and grabbed his arm. But the soldier began to cough loudly. When the robbers heard this, they threw down their knives and forks, jumped up, and discovered the two strangers behind the stove. "Aha, gentlemen," they cried. "Why are you sitting in the corner? What do you want here? Have you been sent to spy on us? Just wait, you'll learn how to fly on a dead branch." "Mind your manners," the soldier responded. "I'm hungry. Give me something to eat. Afterward, you can do what you want with me." The robbers were startled, and the leader of the band said, "I see you are not afraid. Good. We'll give you something to eat, but then you must die." "We'll see about that," the soldier responded, and he sat down at the table and began to hack heartily at the roast meat. "Brother Sparkle Boots, come and eat," he beckoned the huntsman. "You must be just as hungry as I am, and you won't find better roast meat at home." But the huntsman refused to eat, while the robbers watched the soldier with astonishment and said, "Nothing bothers this guy." Afterwards, the soldier said, "The food was not half bad. Now bring me something good to drink." The leader was in a good mood, so he tolerated this too and called to the old woman, "Fetch a bottle of wine from the cellar and make it one of the best." The soldier pulled the cork from the bottle until it popped. Then he took the bottle to the huntsman and said, "Pay attention, brother. You are going to be amazed. I'm now going to make a toast to the health of the entire band." Next, the soldier swung the bottle over the heads of the robbers and cried out, "To your health, but open your mouths wide and raise your right hands in the air." And he took a hearty swig. No sooner had he pronounced those words than the robbers all sat there motionless, as though they had been turned into stone. Their mouths were open and their right arms were raised in the air. The huntsman said to the soldier, "I see that you know tricks of another kind, but now come, it's time to go home." "Oh, old buddy, we don't want to march home too early. We've defeated the enemy, and now we are entitled to collect the booty. They are planted there solidly with their mouths open in astonishment, and they cannot move until I let them. Come, eat and drink." The old woman fetched another bottle of the best wine, and the soldier did not get up from the table until he had consumed the equal of 3 days' food. Finally, when dawn approached, he said, "It's time now to break our tent, and the old woman will tell us the shortest way to the city so that our march won't be too long." When they reached the city, the soldier went to his former comrades and said, "I have found a nest of nasty birds out there in the forest. Come with me and we will clean it out." As the soldier led the way, he said to the huntsman, "You've got to come along and watch how they flutter when we grab them by their feet." He stationed his comrades in a circle around the robbers. Then he took a bottle of wine, drank a swig, swung the bottle over their heads, and cried out, "To your health." Suddenly the robbers could move again, but they were thrown down on the ground and their hands and feet were bound by rope. Then the soldier commanded his comrades to throw the robbers onto a wagon like sacks. "Take them right to the prison." Meanwhile, the huntsman took one of the company aside and gave him an order as well. "Brother Sparkle Boots," the soldier said, "we've taken the enemy by surprise and provided well for ourselves. Now we can take our time and march back to the city as stragglers." When they approached the city, the soldier saw a crowd of people rush from the city gate, utter a loud cry of joy, and wave green branches in the air. Then he saw that the entire royal bodyguard was bringing up the rear. "What's the meaning of that?" he asked the huntsman in complete astonishment. "Don't you know," answered the huntsman, "that the king has been absent from his realm for a long time? He's returning today, and everyone has come out to greet him." "But where's the king?" the soldier asked. "I do not see him." "Here he is," the huntsman replied. "I'm the king. I had my arrival announced in advance." Then he opened his huntsman's coat so that his royal dress could be seen. The soldier was horrified. Immediately he knelt down and begged to be forgiven for having unknowingly treated the king as his equal and for having called him by such familiar names. But the king took his hand and said, "You are a good soldier and you saved my life. From now on you will have everything you need. I'll make sure of that. And if you ever want a piece of good roast meat, as good as the one in the robber's house, you just have to go into the royal kitchen. However, if you want to make a toast to anyone's health, you will first have to get my permission." So that is a fairy tale that was written actually by one of the Brothers Grimm, so it wasn't the... I'm looking in my book. It wasn't something that they collected. It was something that one of them wrote, and I can't remember. It was Jacob. I think it was Jacob Grimm. When I've been reading fairy tales again, which has been great since being in residence and using this time to sort of feed my head a little bit in those ways. Hello. And I actually, from Barbara Weisberger, who's another artist who is in residence here. Come on in. Hi. Broadcasting live on the internet. You should come in. And it's just chatter. Come on in and have a look around. Yeah. She loaned me a book called Northern Folk Tales, and it actually comes from the town where I grew up. It comes from a secondhand bookstore in the town where I grew up, of Los Gatos, California. And I feel like there's been a lot of small, interesting connections like that since arriving in a new place. So Deb's been using the time to learn how to fish. Mark's been fishing with Dove, monitoring that, and been using the time to put up a bunch of prints from the last year or two and live with them and try to figure out which will be edited, which will be printed, which will be printed which size. and I'm figuring out the radio again, doing some reading
of fairy tales, folk tales, Montana fact practicing, doing more talking about yodeling than actually practicing yodeling. I have a great book with some yodeling facts and just history. And then I have a CD, sort of a how-to CD that I've been listening to, and just got it on my iPod today, so go into the woods and practice some yodeling. Hi.
Hi.
I'm broadcasting live on the internet. If you guys would like to talk about coming to the refuge or your connection to the refuge, that'd be great.
I used to live here.
Oh, you did?
I used to live in this room.
Oh, in this room?
In these rooms.
Oh, wow, great. On this whole floor?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Were you in residence? Or you?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
For 3 years, I monopolized this space and wouldn't let anybody else have it. Because, as you know, it's really great.
It is pretty great. Especially in the afternoon.
Except for really heats up in the summer.
Yeah. Yeah, it hasn't been too hot since we've been here.
For about an hour.
Yeah. So you're also an artist?
I am. I'm a painter.
Oh, painter. This is the perfect space for a painter.
Great space for a painter.
Yeah, I feel like my pictures seem so tiny in here. I print them bigger, but as I'm living with them and editing, and they feel a lot kind of lost in here.
But that's okay, because it probably is forcing you to make even more and more to try to fill it up with numbers.
Yeah.
To take up more space. Right?
Yeah, and it's I mean, in New York where I live, I don't have the space to put them up at all. So
the scale of where you live will change your point of view.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you know that's Jim Hoare right there? Famous no. Montana artist?
Hi.
Hi. Very famous.
Good
Montana
to meet
artist.
You.
Very easy to like. Your
work very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Nice to have you in Montana.
Thank you. And are you also a painter?
I'm a painter.
Oh, great.
Great painter. You can see some of his work next door at the hallway.
In the hall? Okay, I will. Oh, it's so nice. It's so nice to have you come and support, and I get to meet people.
I always feel like when I come up here, people are living in my house.
Yeah.
Having been here for 3 years in the last show, I was very possessive about this. I still am.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about these window blinds.
about the what?
Window blinds. No.
Thanks for bringing all the arts, bring so much to our area, and comments and techniques, all the things we hear you all talking about, and it's very rich.
Yeah, well, it's such a give and take, you know. It's such a give and take, because it gives us so much. And just my family to be here, it gives so much to our family, let alone to my work and my husband.
Well, it's cultivating back there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's
fine. He thinks the stage is for him. You guys could get an arm wrestle.
No,
you
could see. He's probably smaller than I am. I bet I can take him.
Yeah.
But
he's three,
he's
and
strong.
He's got a lot of endurance.
He's
yeah. Thank you. Good to meet you.
Do you live in Manhattan?
I live in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn.
Yeah, and where are you now that you're not up here?
I have a place out in Boulder Valley, just a few miles down the road,
uh-huh.
Where I have Van Eyck Studio, and this is my agent and an artist in his own right. This is Al Swanson.
Hi, good to meet you, Erica.
Al is a wood genius, a would-be genius,
wannabe genius.
You will have seen, if you go to Helena, you'll see his work all over the place.
Okay, great.
And
he has Swanson Gallery.
Wait, okay. I have to write everything down.
I'll leave you a card.
Oh, great, thank you.
Yeah.
And is your work in this gallery as well? Okay, oh, super.
And it's also downstairs.
What's your name again?
Haken. My last name is Haken. H-A-Y-K-E-N. This name is Michael.
Okay, great. And so
Did you come to the residency and then decide to stay? Is that what happened?
Yeah, you sound like you're pretty familiar with that idea.
Well, a few people know. Well, we have friends who've been coming here for 5 years, Barbara and Eric. You've probably met them if you're around.
Yeah, I've met them. Yeah, sure. I think this, not by name.
This is their fifth summer coming here. And so just through their experience, we understand. And then we've met a few people who came in residence and then decided to stay. Mm-hmm. Where are you guys from originally?
When I came here, it was after living for years in Key West.
Florida. Oh, wow.
And then I ended up splitting my time between Key West and Montana, 6 months each.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm selling a place in Key West and going to still split my time between here, but now here in Tucson.
Oh, nice. I went to school in Tucson for a year.
Did you?
Yeah.
It's a great town, right?
It is really great.
Totally a cool town.
It
beautiful
is.
Country.
Yeah.
I just got a place, I bought a place out on the northeast end of town, up there where Tancredi Road becomes Reddington Pass. Do you remember that area? Where it goes up into the Catalina Mountains,
yeah.
Past Sabino Canyon, and
yeah, I mean, the names are familiar. It was a while ago, and I was just there for a year, but I mean, we did a lot of
the
hiking.
Rural
and
edge. Well, you did a lot of hiking.
Yeah.
I'm right at the, I'm in the eastern district of the Saguaro National Park out there.
That's going to be great.
But I've only been there for a couple of months before I came back here, so.
Yeah.
But it's nice. And Al, where'd you come from?
Maine.
Maine.
Mm-hmm.
He only lives in states that start with M.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
he's only get Massachusetts.
No. Massachusetts. So let's see what you're doing here. Are those your photographs downstairs next door?
No.
Those
are Bill's. He's in the apartment downstairs.
Ah. Love this. Look at this pile of sticks in the right. Beautiful.
Most of those were taken. My husband was, I went with him. He was in residence in Belgium at the beginning of the year. And so I spent a lot of time just photographing and chasing our 3-year-old.
Uh-huh.
And now he's chasing the 3-year-old here.
this looks very Montana.
Yeah, that's California. My folks are.
Jeez, 5 hours on his day.
Yeah, my folks are in the Central Coast, and it is similar to here somehow.
Yeah.
I guess just what grows and.
I love this picture with the big bump on his head.
Yeah.
This is great. Yeah.
So, Al, are you here full time?
Yeah, I live in Helena. Yeah. Yeah, I've lived here 6 years. have a wife, 2 kids. So yeah, we're.
Uh-huh. How old are your kids?
5 and 11 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Yeah.
But it's fun. I mean, Helena's great. Do you get out there much?
We've only been here a week.
Really?
Yeah, a week. In a couple of days, so
oh, wow.
But we've been up there a couple of times to go food shopping and ride the carousel. That's our rainy day.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, we've got great restaurants and great cultural. I mean, it's for a little town. It's a booming little place. There's a lot going on.
Well, Montana seems like that in general.
In general,
there's all sorts of nice.
But we've got some great galleries and the Holton Museum and the Archie Gray.
Is your gallery in the? Oh yeah, it is.
It's in the walking mall.
Okay, great.
Down, so
yeah,
it's definitely worth a look see.
Yeah, we went by once and it was not very smart. It was Sunday and everything was closed, so we'll go by there again.
I know Sundays and Mondays are our closed days.
Yeah.
As a lot of the places like that, but Tuesday through Saturday we're there.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. But if you do get up, it'd be cool to have you come by.
Yeah,
just
definitely.
Just give us a call if you're even around and we're not open. I'll even give you my cell phone number.
Okay, great.
That guys are coming with it's hilarious.
Okay. That was our birth announcement.
This is our kinder day in Holland, isn't it?
It's Madurodam.
Oh, Madurodam.
Okay. Yeah, it's in Holland, yes.
Yeah. Cool place. Messes with your head.
It's a crazy place.
Yeah, I
used to have relatives in Holland when I was a kid, and I just have all these, every time we go to Madurodam, so I have these really weird memories of this place. Mm-hmm. So when we were back, I wanted to go back to photograph. It was interesting to go back as a grown-up person.
Well, those photographs, I was just thinking as I read through here, this one, scale-wise.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I can't. I haven't decided these pictures of Madurodam. There's like three that I really, really like. The helicopters, just because of the helicopters, and the water slide because the scale is just so bizarre. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I can't decide.
I like this.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I can't decide if they all need to exist, or if just like three of them do. And that's already an edit from.
That's cool. Do you want to head down the road?
Sure.
Very nice to meet
you.
Yeah,
great to meet you. Alright, I'm kind of wired, but.
So, how long will you be here for?
We're here just for the month. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then back to reality.
Are you enjoying it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's interesting because we were just in Belgium, and I was telling my husband last night, like, somehow it feels even more different here than it did there. And like,
more foreign.
Yeah, more foreign.
More exotic.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I can't quite put my finger on it. Maybe because it's less expected that it would be different, like, because it is the U.S., and I don't know. But somehow it's a lot different.
In a way, it's like the land that time forgot.
Yeah.
Especially Daisy.
Yeah.
Especially Daisy.
It's,
for sure.
It's amazing. I feel like, I guess you guys are artists also, so you can kind of, like, visually or somehow you put your finger on things. Like, you kind of assess situations, and you feel like you understand them, and I feel like I'm still doing that here, and usually...
So do I, 10 years later.
Yeah, okay.
12 years later.
Well, mm-hmm. That's...
Well, very nice to meet you.
Yeah, great good work. To meet you, and I hope to see you in Helena.
Please.
All right, enjoy your new Tucson.
Thanks.
6 months, too. Yeah, I'm envious.
Take care. You're in Tucson, yeah.
Okay.
See
you. All right, take care. Hi. So, secret history of yodeling around the world. And I was just reading about a woman. Sounds the page is turning. There's a woman named Erica Stuckey who yodels, and she's standing with a raven, which is one of... We saw ravens the first few days we were here. From the practice CD.
This is Carrie Christensen saying Auf Wiedersehen and happy yodeling.
Hi.
This is Kerry Christensen saying Auf Wiedersehen and happy yodeling.
So that wasn't exactly what I wanted to play, but
you have to walk to your house to get to your studio.
Yeah. If you need a rest or a drink of water. So I'm broadcasting live on the internet here, and I'd love to talk with any of you about what brings you to the jazz brunch benefit today.
Well, I can shoot off my mouth. You know.
Okay, this is on. So
So you. What do you want to know? Why I came to the jazz brunch?
Well, what's your name?
My name is Martin.
Martin, and are you in Basin or are you?
I'm in Basin today for the jazz brunch.
And you're in Basin today.
You came from Helena.
And you came from Helena.
And well, I especially like the jazz at the brunch.
Yes.
And today we get a chance to hear both Kelly Roberti and Bob Nella, which is a tremendous experience. And then, you know, it's always a great time to meet friends and visit, and you know, because everybody comes from the nearby community to the brunch.
Yep. And so you've been coming for a few years?
Yeah, for a few years and off and on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, we're associated with the Artist Refuge indirectly as contributors, and I just kind of keep track of what goes on here because it seems like a pretty good program.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I guess that's probably the main thing, is that we believe in the program at the Refuge and think it's a pretty terrific thing they've done here.
Yeah.
Right? And I especially like the way this program is set up, because the people and the variety of disciplines that are represented are so different.
Yeah.
And varied.
Yeah.
You know, like that.
Just now there's composer, painter, photographer, writer, uh-huh, in residence, and me.
So this is a new kind of a twist. Let me ask you a little bit about what is live internet.
Well, it's if you logged in onto the website below, there's a live stream of us talking. So anybody anywhere in the world with internet connection can listen in. And I've been doing this project, this radio project that started during the Republican National Convention when it was in New York City, which is where I live. It's just another forum for people to talk, to meet people. I get kind of overwhelmed by being talked at all the time. And ideally, I like, now I'm using the phone connection, but ideally I like to do it where people can call in and we can have conversations across great distances. And so, I'm really interested in place and people.
Oh.
And it's a nice way to meet people and
learn about a particular place.
It's definitely
Montana.
it's that
mining Montana.
Yeah.
You know, which in western Montana, which is what most people think of when they think of Montana. But of course, this is the smallest part of Montana. The greatest part of Montana is a semi-arid plains, you know, and desert and grassland, and
mm-hmm,
you know, not it's totally different from this western third of the state.
And so is that mostly northeastern or just all eastern?
Just all eastern. Pretty much everything east of the Continental Divide is a whole different,
mm-hmm,
Montana than,
mm-hmm,
two-thirds. Two-thirds. The greatest two-thirds of Montana is the Great Plains. I grew up in the mountains.
Yeah.
And when I went out, I taught school at a little country school in southeastern Montana. And I was very surprised at the difference. I mean, in the mountains, you know, to walk 20 miles is a struggle. Mm-hmm. But out on the plains, you can walk. In half a day, you can walk 20 miles. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different kind of landscape, you know. And it's, plus it's way more populated with critters mm-hmm. than western Montana, primarily because there's more food source. You know, the mountains are mostly, actually the mountains are mostly the water collection facility for the United States, mm-hmm. for North America, and that's its primary purpose ecologically, is to collect water. And of course the miners found that that's where the gold was, and that's that's what drew the populations. And but Basin is a, you know, a real nice example of just kind of that mining Montana mentality that happened at the end of the 19th century. And,
he's got a critter.
Oh, it's a daddy long leg.
Okay,
they're not a spider, they're an insect.
They eat the mosquitoes, we like them.
Okay, yeah, he's okay.
And so how is the water in these areas after all of the mining, or I guess the mining continues in some places, but...
Well, of course, the problem with mining is that it just it disgorges all of this mineral material from that's been locked in the earth forever, and in the course of that disgorging, then it, you know, it drops it into all the watersheds. And it ends up somewhere in the oceans, mm-hmm. and you know, or it ends up in your well, mm-hmm. wherever you are downstream, or it ends up in your basement if it's petroleum products. But mining is, I think the mining mentality is primarily one of just tear it out of the ground and let somebody else worry about it after that.
Right. Right.
They're after the mineral. And the concern for what happens to the material that's left over and the disruption that's left over isn't the concern of the miners. And so that's always left to somebody else, not only to think about and take care of, but also ultimately to pick up the bill for. And, you know, I mean, they talk about how valuable mining is as economic development, but in the long run, I think if we put back against that all of the costs of reclamation, you know, it might not look like such a grand wealth after all.
Right.
Of course, we're doing those restorations 150 years after the disruption took place, so it costs way more now than it probably would have then. So.
Right.
Although, turning that another way is that we understand better how to do it right than what they would have then, and we have the equipment and machinery and engineering to do it. So I think we do a better job of reclamation than they probably would have in earlier times.
It's nice to hear you speak sort of positively.
Certainly, everyone's interested in making us the Silicon Valley of reclamation.
Well, here you should sit down. I grew
up in Silicon Valley. Come, there's two chairs. You guys can share. tell me your name, please.
Tad Weaver.
Tad. Hi. Erica. Yeah. I grew up in Silicon Valley, and I remember when I was in college, people saying that we had the worst water in the country because of all of the microchip manufacturing. And it was just interesting. One of my professors was really into photographing water systems, and so he talked a lot about it. Anyhow, but what were you're saying that they're talking about turning Montana into the Silicon Valley? Or?
Well, we have very good mining reclamation studies going on in the state as a result of some Superfund sites and mm-hmm. so on. And people are kind of recognizing the expertise that's present in our area, and the idea has been raised that as Silicon Valley became a center for chip making,
right.
that we might become a center for reclamation.
That's interesting.
And we certainly do reclamation things in Wyoming, for example, mm-hmm. and we surely are sending students, you know, I don't know what the range of that is, but to many different places.
Mm-hmm.
Montana State University, right?
Well, that's where they all go, isn't it?
Well, I'll say yes.
Promote his industry a little.
Is that your industry?
I hang out with those people. It's not the center of my industry.
The university or the reclamation people?
Some of
it. Some of each. Some of each. And what do you guys do? Are you artists or?
I'm a plant ecologist.
A plant ecologist. Oh, great. And you?
I'm a regulator.
I regulate underground
storage tanks.
Uh-huh. Underground storage tanks of
primarily petroleum tanks, gas stations.
Oh wow.
Fuel oil and gasoline and waste oil primarily.
But Martin is also an artist.
Yeah, you have that look about you. Yeah. And you're here today.
And this is like internet radio.
Yes.
Is like what it amounts to?
Yes, exactly.
And so you're through a DSL connection or a phone line connection?
Because Montana, I'm just learning so much about Montana, but it's so interesting that internet connection, they have a DSL connection here, a wireless connection, but it's closed. You can't send out, and the reason is because they don't want people tapping in to people's computers through it. This is the first I've ever heard of that. I've only heard of like open wireless. So I couldn't send out through the wireless here because it's closed. And I need a port to go out. So I'm doing it through dial-up, which is just a little bit slower in terms of people loading it. It rebuffers. I don't know if you've ever listened to internet radio stations before, but sometimes it takes a little while to like reload it up and then. But then all of these programs get logged into an archive on my website as QuickTime files, so you can listen to them anytime. But right now it's going out live. Yeah.
Well, and is this primarily what your residency is about?
Well, I wanted to come and do something that would make me talk to people and meet people and learn more about the place. And so I thought doing this project, and then I'm also taking pictures here. But the way I photograph is kind of slow and a little bit set up, so it's nice to be doing both. I get to learn about people and the place at the same time, and they influence each other, the way the pictures happen. Yeah, and it's also just, I live in New York, I live in Brooklyn, and I don't have time to read, I don't have time to write in my journal, I don't have time to look at my pictures in this way, and it's been a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. What makes the difference between being here in Basin and being in Brooklyn, in terms of having the time to look?
Well, one is that my husband has agreed that he'll be the primary caregiver to our 3-year-old, because the 3-year-old, like, that pace goes with us everywhere. So it's not like that changes, but it's also not having the same social networks. And I teach in New York, I teach photography, and I love being connected to the university, but it's a lot of talking to students, it's a lot of going to panels, it's a lot of meetings, it's a lot of prep. So that stuff is in New York.
We probably all find those things if we stepped out of our own society.
Yeah.
That life would slow down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the networks is definitely the jammer.
Yeah.
All the networks the networks and obligations that you involve yourself with.
And that you love to do, but it's really a gift to be able to go away. You know, we're involved in helping a school start up in Brooklyn that we really appreciate the philosophy, and so we work, I think about that a lot, and I do a lot for that. And so we came here and I don't have to do those things for a month.
Someone told me about retiring at 65.
Uh-huh.
You retired at 65 because Bismarck discovered that that's when we should retire. By the time we're 65, our offices have become so full and our social networks have become so large that there's no time left over for anything else.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea. I don't know if it's true or not.
Yeah. That makes me think of a older woman mentor of mine when I first had my son, and I was like, you know, where did time go? Like, what? And she says, the older we get, the more we add to our lives, but we don't take things away. And I had never thought about it from that perspective before. And every once in a while, I have to think about, okay, I'm adding this thing, and this, and I have to be more conscious about that choice of adding it. It's like you're saying, your office filling up and your networks. Yeah.
So I grew up in a little Montana town just right over the hill.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you could walk from there to here
uh-huh.
in the day
over the hill.
Yeah. And my wife and I met in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
And one of the things that, after having lived on St. James Street, or whatever the name of the place was, for a few months, riding my bike down into, I guess it was South Brooklyn, there were all of these little residential neighborhoods, with a single house and little yard, and I just thought, you know, I mean, I grew up in that kind of a community, but seeing that there in the middle of this densely populated city, I just thought, boy, something's wrong here. Why do they have so much space?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty weird.
Well, in Brooklyn used to be, I mean, the term hick comes from Hick Street in Brooklyn. Like, a hick meant somebody that was from Brooklyn, because before there were bridges, like, that was the farming country for the city.
Okay.
And, those houses, some of those houses, they're amazing old Victorian houses with yards, and some of them were country houses for people in Manhattan. And I mean, now I live in Brooklyn and I go to Manhattan every day to work. It's not a country house. It's interesting. Yeah. So what were you doing in Brooklyn?
I was a resident at the Brooklyn Museum Art School.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
They were in the 60s. They still only thought of pottery as ceramics. I mean, ceramics as pottery. And out west, we were thinking of clay as a sculptural medium more than as a pottery medium.
Wow.
And so that was one of the entities back there that wanted to upgrade their ceramics department. So there were actually two of us from Montana who were in that program.
And how long? That program doesn't exist anymore, does it?
Well, the program was called the Max Beckman Scholarship. It was and the purpose of that scholarship was to bring people to this urban setting, artists who were kind of at that cusp, you know, weren't sure whether they wanted to go professionally into art or into some other aspect of teaching or some other field even maybe, but the idea was to take those people and give them an opportunity to be kind of immersed in the arts environment, and they were from all over the country, you know, so there was a group of whatever, there were 15 or 20 people, there were sculptors and ceramicists and painters and printmakers that were all part of this scholarship program. And so we all had a kind of a connection from that, and we were on a little bit more focused level than just the regular art school.
Uh-huh.
So it was a really nifty experience, you know, and if you were really interested to, you know, to seek gallery representation, why, there were people in the museum who were willing to make those introductions for
great.
And that just happened to be we were in New York City at the time of the second Andy Warhol show at the Castelli Gallery. And that was a real eye-opener, you know.
Yeah.
We just had been immersed in abstract expressionism for years, and suddenly to really experience this new direction, you know, with the pop artist.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Martin, I'm going to vanish here pretty quick, but I wonder if you'd say, what are the principal art centers in Montana?
Well, of course, the premier and principal art center in Montana is Helena.
Oh,
and then there's Missoula. And Butte is working hard at it. Mm-hmm. And Bozeman has a strong arts community.
Livingston.
Kalispell has an arts community there. And surprisingly, in eastern Montana, Miles City and Lewistown both have little conclaves. They're reasonably dedicated arts people. Well, there are probably more, but those are the ones that come to mind.
One in the plains, and the rest are in the western mountains.
Well, Great Falls, you know, yeah. I mean, I guess there's the... Well, the Great Falls community is really disconnected, though.
Mm-hmm.
They're disconnected from one another, and they're kind of disconnected from this, the rest of what's going on in the state, I think. Hey, how are you? Are you having a good time?
Yes.
Being away from the busy city?
No.
Would you rather be in Brooklyn?
No.
No? Would you rather be in Basin?
Mm-hmm.
In Montana.
How long have you been in Montana?
No.
2 weeks?
A week and a half.
A week and a half, which is brand new, isn't it? Yeah.
I'd like to introduce you guys also to Susan. She's another one of the artists in residence. This is Susan Rushing Adams.
Hi, Susan.
She's a writer. She's going to read one of her short stories.
Oh, I see that, 12:30 to 1:15, right?
Yeah. Well, you said it takes about a half hour. I just wanted to make sure, so... But, oh, it's so great to talk with you,
Bob. It's good to talk with you.
Yeah, yeah. If you come to Brooklyn again, let us know.
Oh, sure.
I have a card up there.
Okay. We will come to Brooklyn sometime.
Okay.
I don't know when, but we love to go back.
Yeah, good. Yeah. We have, my husband went to the children's school at the Brooklyn Museum, and we both had taught art classes there, and so we didn't know about the program that you are doing, but we love that museum. Okay, come on our way over here. Dove loves the hill. Hey Debbie, where's Daddy? Yeah, it's okay. We just want to clean it up before anybody cocks themselves. Yeah, he loves the hill from the gardens. You know, he likes to roll down the hill.
Yeah.
Susie.
Susie,
good to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
And so you were living in Brooklyn when he was visiting?
Well, we had both gone to Brooklyn for the same reason.
Oh, you were in the same program.
And so we just met there. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So you're also an artist.
Yeah.
What medium do you work with?
Photography. Yeah,
great.
I've just been learning Photoshop, and I'm just getting such a hoot out of what you're doing.
Thanks.
And I'm clueless about how you do those.
Those, they're all of these are from negative, and then those have been scanned in. They're two images that are scanned in and then striped next to each other, and then you look at them through this piece of glass that only allows one direction of viewing at a time, so you only see one set of images at a time, and so it gives that sense of flipping, and you can do it to make things look three-dimensional, or you can do it to make things flip and change.
Yeah.
I always say, like, the Winking Jesus postcard.
Yeah.
Have you seen that? You
know, these are really fun. I've enjoyed looking at your
books. Oh, thanks so much.
Oh my
goodness. And what are the trees whose roots are washed out?
Washed
looks like they wrote it out to expose all the roots.
Yeah, it's this crazy forest in Belgium where they call it the Goblin Forest because all the trees, and I'm not sure what caused it.
It has to be erosion.
Yeah. And
the soil must have been, there's at least 3 or 4 feet of soil that moves in this forest without destroying the forest.
Yeah, no, the trees aren't dead. Well, we were there in January. But they're not dead.
No.
I'm gonna be holding.
Okay. Come on. You didn't see Mark? No, okay. I think he said he was going to the office. Yeah, mark yourself on the wall. Thanks so much, Martin. That's wired up here. I could put on another yodel, and we had a glass billing crash. It's pavement. It's not snow, but doesn't. Thank you so much. It's okay. I'll have Marco clean it up when he comes up. Thanks a lot. It's really nice. Yeah. Actually, grab over there. I'm sorry, I'm just connected to all of this. I'm going to put on a song so we can clean up this broken glass, and then Susan will read one of her short stories, Susan Rushing Adams, who's one of the other artists in residence here. Oh, okay, great. It's on in the office. We just had a glass deal. I was just trying to, will you do that? Because I was going to unhook myself so I could clean up. There's a glass that broke over here.
Yeah. I want to see the broken glass.
Thanks. And Mark, over here is Martin and his wife Susie, and they were at the Brooklyn Art School, the Brooklyn Museum's Art School in the 60s.
Cool.
But an older, a grown-up program. Okay, Susan, the hot seat's yours. This is Chaos Radio.
Is it where here?
Yeah, right here is great. And then this is on. That's for you, and I brought you some water too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I
brought you some. Okay. Here you go. I should have used paper to start with. Don't feel like you have to drink. All right. So, Susan, you are one of the other artists in residence. And do you want to start by reading, or would you like to talk about it? It's great to meet you both.
Yeah.
Either way, I can give some background information on my work first, or I can read first, whichever.
Why don't you start with however you feel comfortable. I'm sorry.
Well, I'll give a little bit of background on this short story first. Okay. It's called Birth and Bones, and this is one I've written a while back. A lot of my work deals with healthcare issues, and this short story is from a group about some midwives who live in Texas, and there are different stories written from the points of view of different characters. It's not all from the point of view of one single character. My characters tend to interrupt themselves with factual information about birth, and so the narrative tends not to be just continuous, but it
love to have visual art incorporated into it, and of course we can't do that for radio, so I'll just read this story. It does have a sad moment.
Yeah. Well, there's maybe another reading going on. I'm not sure who's.
I think this is the only reading.
Okay. She's doing a reading. I just wasn't sure if there was something going on at the Jazz Hall also.
We just filmed that.
Oh, okay. So this is the other place. We're doing an internet broadcast, a radio broadcast, and this is Susan Rushing Adams. She's one of the artists in residence, and she's going to read one of her short stories.
Can you give us a couple of minutes and we'll capture
it? Yeah, sure.
Okay.
It takes about 20 minutes to read, so we could talk about my work first. Or
yeah, let's talk about your work and...
Or the refuge, things like that.
Exactly.
One of the things I've enjoyed about being out here is just the interdisciplinary nature of what people do. So not everyone's a writer. I've enjoyed looking at the photographs of Bill's, and he's given me tips on how to improve my photography because I actually incorporate photographs into some of my work. So I've got some new pictures that I think will work better in my stories and things like that. So, and we have from up here. Here in Arca Studio, we have a beautiful view from two different directions of the mountains.
Mm.
So it's a nice place to work. We're right here in nature.
Yeah.
You can walk up in the forest, and just about two blocks down, there's two roads leading into the forest, and that's just been nice inspiration to be able to work.
You've been really going out and riding in the forest and...
Yeah, a few times at least. It's been cloudy and very rainy the past few days. One day I made a break for it when there was a break in the clouds and then got caught in a really bad thunderstorm on the way back. But the weather up here is generally nice. It just tends to be the rainy season right now. So.
And what's your process been like since you've been here? Like how does a day run for you?
It's been different than I thought it would be. I thought I would be up early in the morning writing solid, at least for 4 or 5 hours, taking a break and then coming back to it and trying to take my break time in the evenings. I'm actually finding more that I'm having to spend that time in nature and connecting with the other artists to kind of feed that art. I have been turning out about 4 to 5 pages a day. Reconstructing a novel that I've been working on too, and that's taken some time just sitting and thinking, rereading the work and trying to fit things back together, so to see how things will work over time. I find that it's difficult to be in isolation by yourself completely as an artist trying to turn out work. It's been nice to connect with other people in the community. There's the High Note Cafe that's just up the street too, and I've spent a couple of mornings writing there, and I probably will again too. So that helps feed the art.
It supposedly she's going to be open 5 days now after today.
Is she?
I don't know if that
probably
was
nice,
rumor going around. Yes.
Simon, one of the previous residents here too, also likes to write there in the morning too. So we're set up with our laptops. It's the internet connected, the whole cafe, so it's an internet cafe of sorts.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
You can
do your
research online while you're sitting and writing, too, if you need to look up something. Got the
caffeinating.
Vibrating
fingertips,
yes.
Caffeinating. Yeah, cool. And so what are some of the places that you've explored? You went up the Cataract Creek,
Cataract Creek Road. It's a really interesting place. There are three bridges that you can cross up, and then you can stop. It's a little difficult to turn the car around to get back down, but you can go up there, and you're just right in nature. I walked up with Susan last Monday, one of the artist's wives, and there were no other people that we saw for an entire hour coming back very slowly down the road. I was looking at some wildflowers on one cliff and then looked up and saw that there was an old mine up there, a house, and there are all sorts of abandoned mines both on this road and on the Basin Creek Road too that you can find. this whole area has a rich mining history to it.
Yes, definitely.
But yeah, the creek and the river on both roads just run right alongside the road, and they kind of pass along from one side to the other underneath the bridges. So,
have you seen any animals or anything?
I haven't, actually, probably because I'm not early enough. Either. You have to be out by 5 in the morning, between 5 and 7, be out and on the road. Bill, one of the photographers, actually saw a couple of elk and a moose. I'm trying to get some writing done in the morning, so I haven't been out that early yet, though I'd like to be. The sun rises really early here.
Yes.
I have seen a lot of birds that I haven't seen elsewhere, and bluebirds are something I've seen many of, which has been a surprise. I've also seen an eagle, ravens, lots of swallows, many birds that I've not been able to identify. There's also, up in the forest, too, a lot of butterflies, varieties that I'd never seen before as well, that I'd like to look up. So.
Great. Yeah. So are you guys ready? Can Susan start talking about her work again? Okay. So you were saying your characters interrupt themselves.
Which I like.
I like. I was like, oh, that's such a great phrase. okay, but that's where you were, so I didn't know.
Right. Okay, so this short story is called Birth and Bones, and since I can't give the graphics or the visual art with it, I'll just read the story as is. And this story is from the point of view of a woman named Fran, who's a midwife, and she actually, during this birth, things kind of go awry in it, and not only does she fall holding the baby, but she injures herself too. And one thing that a lot of people don't know, and one of the impetus for writing this story, is that women's risk of dying for breast cancer is exactly the same risk as their risk of dying from osteoporosis. It's 2.8%. And so this story deals a lot with bones. That's why it's called Birth and Bones. So it ties those things, women's health care issues, together.
I'm getting chills just like thinking about it all because I'm so close to birth also.
Yes,
and then
in September. September. Yes,
yeah. And so I'm sorry I have to interrupt you also and ask that. So the osteoporosis, it's something from like a fall from osteoporosis, or is it?
She falls during birth because there's blood on the floor,
right,
and she's holding the baby, and so she doesn't drop the baby, but she ends up falling herself and then cracking some vertebrae and kind of disabling herself. There's this myth that osteoporosis tends not to be disabling, and it can be. Just the same as with breast cancer, osteoporosis has to be detected early, and then you're going to increase your chances of living as normal life as possible and being as active as possible into old age.
And so when you say chance of death, just in terms of statistics, not in terms of your characters, but it's related. It's like a fall or something that,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, yeah, actually, I have the severe osteoporosis too, so that was...
Oh, you do? You do?
Yeah.
And 2 children.
Yeah.
2 birth experiences.
Yes. Okay, this story, each section begins with a part of a nursery rhyme, so this is a way to kind of clue you into
I wonder if I should announce that you're going to read and maybe people will want to listen. Just a second. Yeah. Oh. Hi. I just wanted to announce to everyone in the space. Excuse me. Oh. Excuse me. I just wanted to, first thank you all for being here. My name is Erica, and this is the studio that I've been working in. And this is Susan Rushing Adams. She's one of the other artists in residence. She's a writer. And we're broadcasting live on the internet, a radio program, and she's going to read one of her short stories. So if you care to listen, she's reading this short story called Birth and Bones. You can grab chairs from the kitchen. You can sit on the floor. There's stools back here. You can bring down. Yeah.
Okay, birth and bones. Once more. For mothers who wish the birth was just a rehearsal. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. The blood continued to flow, so I sat on the bed, pushed a metal speculum into Tanya, and opened it. I mopped away as much blood as possible with squares of sterile cotton gauze. There was only one laceration, nothing major, but the thick trickle of dark blood continued. I removed the speculum, pushed one gloved hand up into Tanya's uterus, and braced the other hand against her pelvic bone. I swept out the inside of her uterus and removed some thin membranes. Tanya closed her eyes, bit her lip, and whimpered. Her brown skin was wet with sweat. Blood trickled over the edge of the disposable padding and onto the wood floor. I pushed my gloved fist back inside against Tanya's uterus. I compressed it from the outside with the other hand. I felt my hair begin to tumble down from my ponytail, but tried to ignore it. Giving birth is risky. Practicing midwifery is dangerous. To stop postpartum hemorrhage after delivery of the placenta, administer one dropperful of shepherd's purse. Do not use as a preventative, as it can cause dangerous clots. The largest bedroom in the birth center resembled any bedroom in a Victorian bed and breakfast, except instead of making babies, people took them home. I was a nurse midwife, but I had decided to leave behind the county hospital and its regulations. Alina, my assistant, dressed in blue surgical scrubs with the scent of fabric softener still on them, had already wrapped the new baby in a soft flannel blanket and put a knit cotton cap on his head. Elena handed the infant to Tanya's husband and went back to the oak supply cabinet for more gauze. She banged the glass doors shut again. Try Pitocin and Methergen. Methergen can be administered for several days by pill. Tanya let out a deep breath. You should nurse your baby, I said, bumping Tanya's thigh with my elbow to get her attention. Check for fragments by manual compression. Tanya shrugged and closed her eyes, but said nothing. Her face was contracted with pain. Her dark hair was pinned on the back of her head, but a loose strand tumbled across her face. Her gray athletic shirt, though pulled high, was wet with blood and fluid from the newborn's brief rest across her stomach. The scent of peppermint oil drifted up from a washcloth on her pillow, where I had placed it during contractions to reduce her nausea. Mother should nurse the baby so the uterus can clamp down. Elena grabbed the ampule of Pitocin and filled the syringe. I gestured toward Tanya with my head and nodded. Elena pushed the air out of the syringe and injected the Pitocin straight into Tanya's thigh. I should have given the injection, but I did not want to release the pressure on Tanya's uterus. Elena walked over to the mahogany nightstand and picked up the phone to call for an ambulance. Wait, I said, wait for the Pitocin. Do not use cayenne pepper. Despite popular lore, it can temporarily stop bleeding, then cause it to come back full force, unexpected. Each transport to a hospital counted as a black mark against me with the doctors at the hospital, and a black mark against the parents who chose not to give birth there. A young woman like Tanya was vulnerable to accusations of abuse just for attempting birth with a midwife. Each of my births with a complication was viewed by the obstetricians as a case mismanaged, an incompetent midwife, and parents guided by whim rather than sense. Elena took Tanya's pulse and blood pressure, at the lower end of normal, but still normal. Your boy is beautiful. You've got to nurse him, I said to Tanya. I nodded toward the baby. I continued to apply pressure to the uterus. I knew she did not have the strength to take the baby, but I tried to distract her from the blood and her pain. Tanya whimpered. Her head turned, and she looked at the baby in the arms of her husband. Tanya's eyes took in her baby for the first time. Her husband sat, face still ashen. Elena picked up the newborn from Tanya's husband, lifted Tanya's gray shirt, and held the baby to the breast. With one hand, she grabbed pillows and propped Tanya's arm and the baby against the pillows. The breeze from the window picked up again. Elena grabbed the vial of shepherd's purse and put a dropperful in Tanya's mouth. The bleeding slowed, then stopped. I sutured the second-degree tear that Tanya had. I practiced suturing on raw, muscled chicken. This was easy. The cut ends of the sutures looked like a row of insect legs, the legs of a butterfly turned upside down in a case. The baby let loose his grip on Tanya's breast. I lifted him to examine him and felt my shoes slip on the blood on the wood floor. I held the baby tightly by his ankle and abdomen. He did not fall, but he let out a sharp cry of pain. I did not let go of him as I hit the wood floor. I claimed I was fine, but did not move from the wood floor. Pain, that was a given. It started in the middle of my back and took over. I could not get up. I'll be fine. I just need to sit for a bit. I just need to wait for the pain to decrease, I said. I smelled the peppermint from the pillow and the bed. Each slight movement caused my back to seize again. Elena gathered the baby from me and comforted him. She changed the sheets and tidied up. She helped the mother and the baby to another room. Tanya's husband and Elena helped me from the floor to the bed, an inch at a time. Each movement set off a new wave of pain. Any reasonable person would have called again for medical assistance. Any reasonable person would have insisted. I began to suspect that if my pain was any measure, most women aren't thinking about the baby when they're in natural labor. They don't care about the baby. They just want the pain to stop. Hospitals love to advertise, but they don't mention pain. They have birth classes. You can make plaster casts of your belly, practice relaxation techniques. They have birth balls, rocking chairs, birthing stools, a traction bar for support during squatting, breakaway beds that can be reconfigured. No one gives a shit about the toys or furniture when they're in pain. Each movement sets off a new wave of pain. All the mothers want is to be left alone. All that the mothers want is for the pain to stop. Then the narrator interrupts herself, and there's two visual elements here. One is a pink wristband from, like you see for breast cancer awareness, and on the wristband it says, women's lifetime risk of breast cancer 2.8%, higher for those with risk factors. Risk of breast cancer, 1 in 8. Women's lifetime risk of death from hip fracture, 2.8%, higher for those with risk factors. Risk of osteoporosis, 1 in 4. And that second part is written on a blue bracelet for osteoporosis. You think this is a silent disease. You think I should be silent. You think what you can't see can't hurt. Screw your stereotypes. Then the narrator moves into a flashback to one of her own births. Birth in a small town. The contractions came on quickly and early. I phoned the doctor and he sent me to the local hospital. The contractions came hard and fast, but I breathed through them. I did not believe this was it, nor did the nurses. We measured birth by the clock, not by breath. We measured by time, not by the body, and not much time had passed. My pain was a small black circle in my middle, a small black circle that sat with me through each wave of nausea. The small black circle centered itself in my back and did not leave. The nurses should have been there, but I'd been left alone. Not much time had passed. I felt a rush of fluid and swept my hand down in a panic. I expected to feel a head or a limb. Instead, I felt a loop of cord. The rush of fluid I felt was not amniotic fluid, but blood. The black circle remained. I pushed myself onto my forearms and knees on the hospital bed, lowering my head to the pillow, keeping my hips elevated. I can't hold on to what isn't. This is what remains. Remains. A container for what cannot be contained. I thought ashes were dark, gray. They aren't. They are white. Bones and teeth pulverized. Bones and teeth powdered. I dream. I dream of birth and blood. I dream of ending here. Birth and death, two sides of the same. The gasp for breath, the inhalation, the exhalation. That which moves us forward moves us to the end. In memory. What is memory but a struggle against death? We struggle to forget and dream of death, but time cannot be killed. We struggle to remember and dream of life, but time cannot be contained. What we most want to hold on to escapes us. What we most want to forget follows us to the end. All revolutions are part of the same circle, the small dark circle. Stop the clocks. Stop them here, but keep them going. Keep them going here. The cows are in the meadow, eating buttercups. A tissue, we all stand up. And then this moves back into present time. So stone so strong will last so long, my fair lady. Birth should be measured by the body, not the clock. This is the beginning we work toward. I can't push like this, Tanya said, and cried out. She pulled her gray athletic shirt up further over her belly and tried to lean forward in the middle of the antique four-poster bed. I held Tanya's hand and tried to encourage her. Women have been taught to be polite, not to make too much noise. Politeness doesn't work in birth. They try to be in control, but the only way is to lose control. The same noises that get the baby in get the baby out. Come on, you're doing fine. Let it out, I said. I rubbed her back. Tanya struggled forward. Her husband pulled her up, supporting her under the arms, and she squatted in the middle of the bed. She grasped the sleeve of his check shirt with her fingers, then grabbed his arm. Their eyes met, and his eyes did not look away from her, though her eyes dropped to a space within. Traditional childbirth classes tell parents to pack a focal point or image in their bags to look at during birth. Push, Tanya's husband said, really push. He dropped his eyes, bloodshot from lack of sleep. He watched for his child. He stroked the baby's crowning head. Tanya pushed, and her husband caught the newborn, cradling him in a thick white blanket to keep him from slipping from his hands. I helped Tanya recline against the pillows at the head of the bed, and her husband placed the infant on her abdomen. The umbilical cord stopped pulsing, and Tanya's husband cut it. Tanya rested, and within a few contractions, she birthed the placenta. The childbirth books describe birth as an athletic event, a marathon for which the mother must prepare. Can you do it naturally, without drugs? If you use a drug, do you avoid an epidural? Are there mitigating factors such as extended back labor or artificial induction? Or did you simply fail? It's not a competition. One woman has lost 18% of her bone mass in her hips and 6% in her spine. She has osteopenia, a precursor to osteoporosis. She lifts 40-pound weights to build bone mass but says most older women don't work at it hard. How much bone have the older women lost? It's not a competition. Women fear the pain of childbirth. There's pain worse than childbirth. The winner of last year's Race for the Cure has severe osteoporosis. She can do it. What's my excuse? Don't yell, you're wasting your energy. I don't want to listen to it, said one nurse I had assisted as a student midwife. She set up a full-length mirror so the mother could see herself push, so the mother could see how she was not succeeding at pushing on her back. Natural birth is an unknown in some small towns. The doctors like women in their on their backs. It's convenient. Any woman still smiling between contractions, whether through drugs or some rare trait of personality, loses that smile when the tray is brought in, a tray with rows of sterilized, gleaming silver instruments. I can see the fear in the mother's eyes as she thinks, surely those aren't for me. She thinks that Lester the molester won't use the scissors on her as if she is a piece of poultry. It's in her birth plan. But they are. She never gets what she wants. Step on a crack. You think I can do it. You think I am lazy, ridiculous, a bum. Let me tell you, I don't like to live life on my back. I like to sit up. I like to visit the living room. I like to wash my hair. I don't like pneumonia, bed sores, impaction. I don't like sharp pain from the pressure of a single sheet. I don't like sitting in bed when no one comes. I prefer my Christmas ornaments on a tree, not a traction line. I don't like people grinning and teary as if we're in some damn movie when I stand. I don't like traveling to appointments in the floor of a van. I like to piss in porcelain, not plastic. I don't like being forgotten. Break a leg. This is not about me. It's about birth and women. It's about choices. It's about osteoporosis. This is not about me. It's about your stereotypes and your judgments. It's about judging the young woman who is weak, the new mother whose baby is crying, the laboring woman who goes for the epidural, the laboring woman who has a home birth. What do you think a bedpan feels like after a hip fracture? Sticks and stones. Sorry, I've spilled over the edges. But a few more words. Get your unruly kids away from me. Don't crush my hand. Don't squeeze past me because it's a little crowded. Don't slam me in the back with your purse when you push by late. Don't make me ask for help. Don't disable me. The cradle will fall. Spring comes. I leave my cocoon behind. But I'm no butterfly. I've gone from Cinderella to her sister. I'm hunched over. I'm entertaining. I avoid cameras and mirrors. I leave my wheelchair and walker behind. I hang on to my aluminum crutches and wood cane. The aluminum crutches make a ping-ping as I walk. The wood cane embarrasses people. I don't take it out of the house. I put glittery red stickers on the cane, stickers in the shape of footprints. A police car was parked out at the front curb when Elena and I arrived home from errands. I felt shaky. I knew this was about one of my births. Tanya had taken the baby to the pediatrician. The baby cried all the time. The pediatrician took him away from her. Broken thigh bone, broken shoulder. Charges were filed against Tanya. but someone remembered that Tanya had used a midwife. I had fallen, yes. The baby had cried, yes. But I had not dropped him. Child Protective Services determined I was not at fault, nor was Tanya. The baby had osteogenesis imperfecta, a rare disorder, but the hospital decided it would no longer accept my patients when they had complications. In the birth room, I taped the cardboard boxes from the grocery store to give them support. I opened the oak supply cabinet and began to put my equipment in the cardboard boxes. The windows were closed and no mother squatted in the middle of the bed. I packed waterproof pads for protecting the mattress, speculum, cord clamps, forceps in case the head was stuck, vials of Pitocin and Methergen to stop bleeding. Then there was oxygen and herbs and homeopathics. I hoped I wouldn't need these things, but I couldn't be sure. I didn't forget the xylocaine and the lidocaine, though they don't always work. There were hemostats, suturing supplies, Doppler monitor and stethoscope, blood pressure cuff and thermometers, antibiotics and eye drops, an amnio hook to break the waters. I drove the boxes to the local clinic and left my supplies. I went to my new shift in labor and delivery at the hospital. The nurse on duty handed over the chart. She told me of the mother's progress, almost complete, and she handed over the birth plan with a roll of her eyes. The obstetrician was already there, gleaming silver tools in hand. I sat on the bed. I held the mother's hand. I held my breath.
Oh, it's really moving. Can you talk a little bit about the story? The pregnant lady that cries.
I appreciate avoiding giving this one to pregnant people.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about what brought you to write that?
Yes, when I had my children, who are now 8 and 5, I felt very strongly as I began doing my research that I wanted to have them with a midwife rather than a traditional doctor, and I found very good doctors. Though I still feel that there's a lot that's missing from births. With when you bring in all the technology, I feel that the technology is kind of meant for emergencies or to help things. It shouldn't take over this kind of natural process that so many women feel as it changes you. Birth changes you. You feel like you're reborn as a person yourself into just an entirely different life. Did you feel that as a mother too?
I had a crazy birth experience. We can talk about it.
Yeah, my first birth and my second birth were very different too. But I did have more interventions with technology in my first birth. And so even though it was what most people would call natural, I saw, as difficult as that was for me, that if you don't make an effort to, I guess, keep the emphasis on a new life being brought into the world, you lose a lot. And I know one of the goals is to, you know, prevent any kind of emergency from happening. But there's a lot of psychological damage that can be done to women too during birth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because in the story, it's a little bit unclear. Like, it seems like you're really examining harshly both home birth and hospital birth, or it's like neither one is.
Yeah, and one thing I'm actually worried about with this text, I know there are many doctors who do are more concerned with women's well-being to birth now too, and I actually have a doctor read this story now, and he feels that it does work. I didn't want to dichotomize too much and feel that have people feel that there's this kind of opposition between the two communities that may or may not be there in some places. So this is one character's experience, and I kind of worry whether people will take that as me saying that it's representative of all women's experience or of all doctors, and it's not meant to be that way at all. So I think by pushing things to the extreme during fiction, you can see how badly things can go. So.
It does seem like you are pushing to the extreme.
Yeah.
And do you feel like that's something that's
I mean, that must be something that continues through your work.
Yes, it's actually something that I've been taught to do.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and so what is the other that you
got? The other work that I've been doing while I'm here too is work on a novel that I started 2.5 years ago. It's set in North Carolina during 1943 while many of the men are away at war. There are two main characters, Catherine Lozano and Thomas Kinzer, and they each have equal weight in the novel. They both are speakers in the novel, so the chapters alternate the narration. There are race issues in this book too. One of the characters is African American and she doesn't have the same job opportunities that Catherine does, though they are very close friends. Catherine actually kind of shakes things up by giving this character I recently renamed Phoebe, actually, by giving Phoebe a job in the pharmacy. So, and then things kind of all heck kind of breaks loose when her father returns back home and Phoebe's working there too. I think a lot of people know that after World War II, the women who had been able to work and to kind of integrate family life and work life in entirely new ways, that was kind of ripped out from under them once the GIs came back home and they needed jobs themselves. So I explore those kinds of issues too. It's also a love story between two of the characters too, just absolutely tend to be too stupid to realize that each one loves the other. So you can't have a novel too much without a conflict, so I had to place impediments between them to be able to get it to work. It's actually started off as a novel in verse form, and then it wasn't working because I couldn't say enough of what I wanted to say, so I had to go back to school to learn some of the fiction techniques that I needed to do.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. So what can you give, I don't know if an example is the right way to say it, but what do you mean? Like, what did you need to learn? Like, what's one of the techniques?
Well, writing fiction is very different from writing poetry. You use different devices. You have to write things out more. You pick up, some of the things you use are the same. You have to pick up more objects. You have to give more physical descriptions of people. And you've got to make it feel like a rich and complete world. What John Gardner called it was a vivid and continuous dream. You have to be able to cause the reader to dream without pulling them back out of it at any point and without losing the narrative. In poetry, you kind of do the same thing too, but it's on such a smaller scale. And you can only give some small details that are meant to represent many, many more details. So it's kind of like a picture in miniature. And so writing things out maximally was something that was difficult for me to do at first. Ted Kooser, poet laureate, in his recent book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, he compares pulling readers out of a poem to drop sunglasses. So it is possible to do that in a poem too, where you put something in there that doesn't work and doesn't fit with the rest of the poem. But for me, it's been more difficult to learn those techniques in fiction than in poetry. So to maintain a continuous voice for that long, to have different characters' voices that feel continuous and yet different from one another, where you keep each one's individual style, that's a very difficult thing to do. So even within the space of 3 or 4 pages, sometimes I find the voice is changing and I have to go back and change that to get it to work.
Great, thanks. It's so exciting to hear like process for me, like having different processes, so thanks for talking about that a little bit.
Sure. It's great to be here. There's so many artists here today. This is a great community.
Yeah. It's
people
amazing.
Coming in and out looking at your artwork on the wall.
Yeah. And that's funny. The TV station.
Mm-hmm. That was an unexpected surprise. I hope the short story wasn't too graphic for them to be able to
play. I'm sure they'll find like a nice like a little exactly to edit.
I actually emailed Erica last night to ask her. I gave her a few sample paragraphs from that story. My novel right now I've been working on in separate scenes, so it's less continuous. I'm trying to glue it back together and to both expand it and glue it back together. Mm. But I emailed her the first several paragraphs of that story and asked her, is this okay? Is this going to be too graphic for your audience? And she said, no, it's fine.
Yeah, no, the radio audience, I'm sure, is like, give it to me. Lay it on.
You're all wrapped up.
Why?
Why? I don't know.
You did it. A cozy king. So Susan's going to read another one of her stories, Debbie. You want to sit and listen?
Do you want to sit and listen to this one? It's about little kids. This is actually just a very short excerpt from the novel. These are the pages I worked on yesterday. Normally when I'm writing, I can produce about a page an hour, but this one took me. This one was a revision of one page. I expanded it into five pages, and it took me all day to do it. So that's the process sometimes, too. Things end up taking a lot longer than you think. And this is the character that I wrote, Phoebe, and the narrator, Catherine. Remember that Phoebe is African-American and that Catherine is white, and so their childhood experiences, though they're close friends, they have very different kinds of opportunities and very different kinds of difficulties that they have to deal with. Phoebe met me at the edge of the woods, and we darted to the place where the creek ran smooth, past the patch of dry brown stickers and past the clearing where robins worked their way through the new green grass. We scrambled fast and hard over the uneven ground to the line of trees that grew along the creek. Huge white clouds piled above us, but what we could see of the sky behind was a light and luminous blue. We dumped our blue and green plaid satchels among the dandelions and walked to the creek. Phoebe spun herself in tight, quick circles, arms open wide to the sky, then stopped and skipped to the edge of the water. I followed at a slower pace. There, under a low-hanging tree branch, Phoebe bent down and stirred the water with a fine and spindly twig. With her fingers, she poked sharp green shoots at the water's edge and laughed. Still grasping the twig, she squatted in the mud, her navy boots lighter in spots from speckles of dried dirt. Her twin black braids, the ends tied with pink yarn, swung forward over her shoulders. She pushed one black braid back over her shoulder with her free hand, wet from the water of the creek. A robin opened his brown wings and took off from the low-hanging branch just above her. Old robin bird singing in the tree comes sailing down, says, chee, 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 Phoebe sang, making up her own song. That's how I remember Phoebe now singing, the lilt of her voice lifting to the trees above as we played in the woods after school. Phoebe tossing her long black braids over her shoulder. Sometimes I sang with her. That day I didn't. Gazing up at the white clouds and spots of pure blue sky above us, I whirled in a slow circle on my heel. I whirled again and kept whirling, turning until I felt dizzy, then stopped. My stomach lurched hard. The white clouds continued to turn above me. I looked down and focused on my tan boots to stop the whirling. A brown grasshopper popped up high among the blades of green grass, landed on the toe of one boot, and jumped back into the grass. I bent down and plucked two handfuls of the grass and let the green blades fall from my hands. My brown hair fell forward. Wild, Mama called it. She was always telling me to comb it, even when I just had. Come on, sing with me. Let's sing rounds, Phoebe said, her voice ringing out among the pines. She began again. Old robin bird singing in the tree, and waved her brown hand at me to get me to join in. Phoebe's voice held onto that last word, sounding over the rush of the creek dropping over the stones below. Her voice wavered with what my music teacher and Annie's mama, Mrs. Barnhill, called vibrato. Phoebe waved again, but I shook my head. I didn't join her singing. I climbed down on the broad, uneven rocks just below the creek bank, and stepped wide to the round, wet stones in the middle of the creek, careful not to let my tan boots slip or let the hem of my sky-blue skirt get wet. My mama had paid Phoebe's mama to make my skirts and dresses, and Phoebe's mama had made her some just like mine. Phoebe wore hers, too, that day. Phoebe bent over the water again, making circles in it with her stick and kept singing. The creek was shallow. Had I grabbed the wooden ruler from my blue and green plaid satchel and poked it into the gritty bottom of the creek, the water wouldn't have reached the top. The water passed like a thin film of moving glass over low round rocks and pebbles under its surface. I squatted low to look for the small silver fish that sometimes swam by. The hem of my skirt dropped into the water and my hair fell into my eyes. My stomach dropped. I sighed and looked over at Phoebe, with her skirt still clean and her hair still neatly braided. Somehow Phoebe never made the mess as I did. "What's the matter with you?" Phoebe asked, her voice light and cheerful. "You in love with some boy?" "Of course not," I said, and rolled my eyes. Phoebe knew how I felt about the boys. Wasn't a single one of them worth choosing, not a single one of them worth marrying, ever. I'd figured out that much already, and I didn't see changing my mind since I didn't see those boys changing either. They liked to snap their pink bubble gum in their stinky mouths and pull my long hair hard. I had stopped wearing my hair in braids when that old JT dipped mine in the inkwell. That made my mama mad. She said I shouldn't be so careless. "You are too in love with some boy," Phoebe said. "Probably that old Lanier. He's still sending you notes?" I made a face and didn't answer. I stepped back across the rocks onto the bank of the creek. I walked over to a sycamore that sat low among the tall pines and slid my back against it until I sat on the ground, careful to sit on the grass rather than in the soft dirt. I could hear other children in the distance as they worked their way home. Phoebe looked for fish, too, leaning forward to look downstream past the line of trees to where the creek braided itself into smaller streams. Her black braids trailed over Beth's shoulders again. Her pink yarn ribbons were still tied, her sky blue skirt still neat. A large brown rabbit crossed the path, then doubled back and crossed back into the underbrush. Phoebe never saw it. Phoebe stood up and motioned for me to follow her. She picked up her green and blue plaid satchel from among the dandelions, and I picked mine up, too. "Grass stained," she said, pointing at my blue skirt. I shrugged as if I didn't care, pushed my hair out of my eyes, and trudged behind her so that if I made any more messes, she wouldn't see. Phoebe broke into a run and slowed into a skip, but I stayed behind her. She stopped suddenly, and I tripped and collided with her. Phoebe didn't seem to notice. She pulled at the tangled edges of a young sassafras shoot, tall as either of us, but thin as a spindly twig she used to stir the water. I looked away from her. "My mama says you can dig these up and use the roots for flavor," Phoebe said. "My mama says I can't play with you no more," I said. There, I had said it. Better to be done and not burdened with unsaid words. Phoebe stared at me, silent, arms held stiffly at her side. "She says you're not like us. She doesn't like that." Only then did I look at her eyes. Brown like mine and a mirror of mine, they seemed to say what I could not. There was no taking back some words. I didn't tell her the other things Mama said. "I know what you mean. Just say it," she said. I reached out and broke off a sassafras shoot and began to tear it into small pieces. I wasn't sure what else to say. "It's because I'm black. Just say it," she said. I expected her eyes to fill up any minute, but they didn't. I expected mine to fill up, too. "Your mama doesn't have to know," Phoebe added. "She does know. I don't know, but she does. And the trouble I'd be in if one of Dad's customers saw." I broke off and turned toward a small cedar tree, the cedar tree where we had discovered a bird's nest a few days before, the baby birds squawking for food. The young birds were gone, and now the nest was an empty bowl of twigs. I thought Phoebe would understand that this wasn't my choice, but I wasn't sure she did. I realized too late that I did have a choice, and I had chosen wrongly. That day at the stream, I had lost not just Phoebe, but myself. Better to have caught trouble than to be troubled, but I had lost my chance.
Thanks, Susan.
You're welcome.
Keep thinking about Mama, you know, like you, from your first story to your second story. And I guess it's the way you say Mama, too. Like,
yeah.
But Mama.
It's what I ended up calling my mother and then what my daughter calls me. At first it was Mommy, and that's what I grew up teaching her. For a while she said Mom, but then she just fell into Mama on her own.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my son says,
mm-hmm.
too. I guess it's the old Texas accent thing.
Yeah, that says it, too. But there's something, there's like this larger bubble theme between between the two. It's nice
between the story and
yeah
the actually what I'm thinking about doing is tying these two together these two books and making it intergenerational. And that's what I've been trying to do here, too. Wow. It's difficult and kind of a scary thing to do, too, because you're afraid you'll mess up both projects rather than just one.
Right. It sounds really hard. Like now, like hearing the work, like when you were talking about it before, I didn't really know what it meant, but hearing the work, it sounds it sounds exciting and it sounds hard.
It is very difficult to do. One thing I'm trying to do is to pull out the connections among these two different books, such as Catherine, when she grows up as a pharmacist, so she works in healthcare, and then to tie that into the midwifery and the other book, something I can do in the healthcare issues. I experiment so much with language and with graphics, like you said, with including the photographs. It's very difficult to maintain that continuity because every chapter I want to change what I do. And I need the characters to speak in a consistent way. If Mercy is one of my characters, she gives birth in a cemetery, one of the characters, and she's also a photographer, so she's always taking photographs. So I can't then have another character who does the photographs in her work. It's all got to be that's Mercy. Every single time that I have Mercy speaking in the novel, she's got to be doing some kind of photography, and that has to be included in that. But my tendency is to want to kind of change from chapter to chapter and try out new things.
Mm-hmm.
That I have to force myself to work within those confines, within those boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds... I just think about it from like a visual art process, so you think about that idea of... I teach also, and students like will have a semester for a project, and that's the class to like use the period of time, and then three quarters through the semester, they want to change, or and this like weighing whether it's because they are just bored, or whether because it's important.
I think it is important. And sometimes it probably does come from boredom too. It's probably a bit of both. I think it is important to kind of continue to inject our work with creativity as we go and not go stagnant, always doing the same thing. The problem with doing a lot of experimentalism in writing versus staying with continuous narrative is that you end up, you're taking a huge risk when you do that. And often it's not going to work. You have to be willing to accept that and to scrap huge chunks of work, which I've done, and just leave it alone. And I've been lucky in my education that my teachers have been willing to let me do that experimentation, let me fail, but then also to see where it works, such as using the photographs. That was an experiment that didn't work. I was just so frustrated with the narrative not showing exactly what I wanted it to show, that putting in the pictures that made the cliche picture being worth 1,000 words importance. So many times I've said that I wish I could compose music or do photography on a formal basis or something instead. I guess as artists we all run against the confines of our particular discipline, so whatever that is, the limits of being able to show what you want to show.
Yeah, and I think the difference between writing, well, one of the talking, I think about the difference between writing and photography. I think a lot of times people with photography, because it happens so fast, they're so used to like things changing really fast and things happening fast, and so then there's this like sort of mentality to jump around.
Yes.
Whereas with writing, it's like it's been so laborious, so the change. Yeah, because I find myself more often than not with students being like, no, you need to fall in love with this again. You need to finish it.
Right.
Because I think with photography, it's so easy to not.
Right. You've got to go back to the same places sometimes and re-photograph and do the hard work it takes to get there.
And it's not just that initial buzz of, like, the first.
It is lovely with photography to get the instantaneous feedback, though. You can plug your memory stick into your computer and upload your pictures, and there you are. It's nice. And I think that's why I've enjoyed, actually my first week here, why I did so much photography then, was just wanting it was just so inspiring to be out in nature, and it was difficult for me to just sit and write. So it was like having that instantaneous feedback. And it's worked really well here, actually, in that last section from the novel. A lot of the details that I filled in were from details in the woods here, and the creek and the stones, and walking down to where the water is so shallow and so clear that you can see directly through it.
So nice. I was thinking about that, like, with, when you were talking about the sky and
yes.
the things. I was like, oh, I wonder if that's here. Like, yeah, you know, but how can you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. And that novel, since it's set in Asheville, North Carolina, it's a different sort of mountain environment than it is here. But the mountains right here in Basin are fairly low, so that works well for that. And, you know, the creeks and streams and the rivers and the small waterfalls, you have all that in North Carolina, too. So, but here it is very different, too.
Have you spent time in North Carolina?
Just about 10 days, and then I had not done a lot of work on that particular novel, so I knew some of the things I wanted to incorporate, but not enough. If I took a trip there now, it would be different. There are some interesting sculptures that I've come across through web research, and this is why the web is a blessing, even if you can't travel, too. But they were done by somebody named Barnhill, in North Carolina, and that is actually one of the characters' family names too, so it's this neat little synchronicity that came up. Here, writing about Montana, it's difficult to write. You don't generally want to write something from just being a tourist.
Right.
People do tell you write what you know, but they also tell you that what you know can also be your research. But to really get a feel for the place, you really have to live in it. And I feel that I could write Montana stories now, at least from a Texas perspective,
right.
from being here, much more than I could be just being a tourist and seeing Yellowstone and seeing Glacier Falls, which are some things that we intend to do later on. But being part of a small community here and hearing the stories, Willie was talking about the history of the competitive fire companies and then what's happened with some of the big fires out here. And the ranching out here too, and how, you know, the differences between the big companies versus people who are trying to keep to the small ranching that's more environmentally conscious. So all those things come from an outsider perspective in a sense, but kind of being here and being able to talk with the people here gives a different perspective than I would have had just visiting and
yeah.
coming through.
Yeah, definitely. It feels rich in terms of access of
yeah.
people, like if you came and just rented a house or something. But
yeah.
there's such a rich network through the refuge of people and experiences. And
people are so willing to connect with you too, here is what I found. But just rich source of information.
Well, I
find
still,
instantaneous friends.
Yeah, so I still can't wrap my head around the fact that there's a population of 900,000 people in the state.
Yes.
And how many people are where you?
Well,
are?
I'm in a small town just outside of Dallas. I don't know what the population is of the Dallas-Fort Worth area is, but it's pretty large. I'm from Rowlett. It's considered to be a very tiny town, and I think it's got 40,000 people now,
yeah.
which is got to be comparable.
From eating
to the largest cities here, so
yeah, which is in New York City in the five boroughs, there's 10 million people.
Yes.
So I can't quite put the numbers.
Yeah,
in
it takes
the space
a lot of planning too. You know, you can't get, you better plan ahead to get your gas and your groceries. You're going to be stranded. So
yeah.
it takes a different kind of planning. I was able to use, coming in the first day here, I came in late, close to midnight, just because of some travel difficulties. So, but I was able to use my headlights to write on the interstate. And maybe every 5 minutes or so, a car would drive by and I'd turn back off, but that was just a very odd experience for me.
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time. Dove, Debbie, if you want to stay in here, can you talk with an inside voice, please? it's too loud. I didn't hear the last three sentences you said.
I know, it's just you can drive with your headlights on bright, even on the interstate at night if you're out late enough. And
right.
Everyone tells you to watch out for the animals that could be crossing the road late at night too, which is not something I'm used to. I've seen deer before, but you don't have to watch out for some of the other animals. So.
Yeah.
You know, just different, completely different way of living too. You think there's no 911 access, but you know the fire department's across the street.
Yeah.
So the most exciting thing the first few days here is I think that the fire department set off the fire alarm.
Oh yeah. What do you know? What the story of that was? We
yeah,
heard
actually,
it. And
Willie said that they're just supposed to have a fire department meeting, and so they're supposed to just ring it once.
Oh.
And you know everybody in the town is supposed to who is. A volunteer firefighter is supposed to gather here. They do have volunteer fire departments in most of the small towns because you get a fire in the forest up there, you want to put it out as quickly as possible. And before the state has to get involved, before it spreads, too. But we had just had a thunderstorm, and Steve, the guy who set off the alarm, forgot to turn it back off and had walked across the street. So just having had that great lightning and everything, so half the town comes running and ready. You know, thinking that either there's a car wreck on the interstate or that there's some fire that needs to be put out.
Yeah. So. Yeah, Doug was napping and he sat up bolt right and
yeah.
was like, what's that?
Yeah.
What's that?
It was quite loud. The fire department is right across the street from the refuge. So actually that kind of siren is the same kind of siren we hear with tornadoes in Texas. So that's the first thing I thought. And then I thought, no tornadoes, because I've heard sirens like that before.
It's the same siren as Shabbos in our neighborhood. It's Friday night, like at sundown, there's such a huge Orthodox Jewish community that they have those huge sirens that just announce that, like, okay, now Shabbos is beginning, you need to stop driving or what, all the things.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a nice way to.
Exactly. It's weird. It's
a separate period of time.
And it's such a. But it sounds like a war or something, you know, but it's so the opposite. It's like for the peace. Yeah. So, Susan, your name, is that your middle name or is that your main name? It's so nice.
Thanks.
Susan Rushing Adams. I was like, oh, who's emailing me with such a cool name? Your whole name. You're back.
And you've got a bird name. My daughter has a bird name. Do you want to talk about your art? Actually, one of my favorites on the wall, I don't know what you would call these photographs, but you've got the one on the wall where you've got the woman with the breast pump, and she's got the bags hanging down too from the breast pump, and you move sideways and the view actually changes. And what
it's so it makes the bags empty and then
filled
with
Mama.
Yes.
On to. Breaks more glass.
Oh, that's a not so good idea.
Oh.
I think Daddy's cooking you some lunch.
Push it back.
Push it back. Push it back's making you lunch. You seem a little crazy for food. Oh yeah, I was thinking about with you and what you've been talking about. Being interested in. Birth imagery, and then I don't remember if you said you were interested in representations of motherhood or not, but
for my dissertation, which I have yet to write.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe I'll put on some music for a few minutes. But thank you for reading and talking and that was kind of exciting. There were so many more people. Up until then, there had only been like one or two people at a time.
Too bad.
Four at the most.
Probably since we're concluding.
You mean all of the people?
Yeah.
Or yeah. Nice.
Yeah. It's nice to share stories with other people. Reason for writing.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you feel about reading them aloud?
I like reading them to audiences. This is the first time I've done it on radio, but
mm-hmm.
I've read them aloud where people can see, either see the visual text in workshopping or
mm-hmm.
at conferences. I can either PowerPoint a presentation so they can see the visual art along
mm-hmm.
with
mm-hmm.
the story
mm-hmm.
or print out the photographs or other graphic art on things like cardstock or large paper and then be able to hold that up at the right moments of the story. But I was surprised the story worked as well as it did, just pulling out those graphic elements.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little more difficult to follow since you don't have the visual clues to know where you're changing from section to section within the story. I think that helps people to know, with the way I've written it, when you're switching into the past and then when you're switching back into the
mm-hmm.
present. So.
And are you thinking about using those visuals in your novel as well?
Not in the novel that's set in 1943. If I do, the sections aren't going to have any visual art in them. They have some poetry in them that
mm-hmm.
begins some sections of the novel, and then I've had some music that's from Appalachia from that time period, and I may include some of that, just
mm-hmm.
sections from songs, but I don't know, this one just kind of began as more traditional narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, after I start pulling it out of the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you think about like digital book device kind of?
Actually, I've thought about that, and the other thing I've thought about, which it might be difficult, I haven't worked it out yet. CDs you can produce pretty cheaply and include with books, and so many people do that now as a complement to text, but including some kind of multimedia
mm-hmm.
with the text,
mm-hmm.
either music or some kind of art
mm-hmm.
to go along with it. I wrote one of the sections from the novel while listening to Carmina Burana, and so the rhythms of the particular book or that particular piece and naturally fall in line with that. And I had Carmina Burana stuck in my head for a long time because I had to put the tape
uh-huh.
on a loop to be able to write that.
Uh-huh.
So to be able to have someone listen to that text at the same time that they're reading the
uh-huh.
novel, it definitely helps kind of underscore the mood and what's
hmm.
going on between the two characters.
Hmm.
And the other character kind of writes from the perspective of a different piece in Carmina Burana too. So I think something like that would be really fun to do. It may exceed my abilities at this point. Actually, it's probably going to be very hard to publish some of this work because
right.
you look in the journals and there aren't that many that include photography. Some of this is in color, so I'd either have to, when you have blue and pink wristbands, you'd either have to take it out or do something different. Web publishing is one possibility
mm-hmm.
with it too. So the web text, you can have all kinds of opportunities that you don't in traditional print, though
mm-hmm.
I love traditional
yeah.
print journals. It's a huge expense to have to print something in color, so I know that from doing that.
Right.
Too, so.
Yeah. I keep hearing about like that books or our relationship to books, everything's going to change, and like hypertext novels, and so
yeah.
kind of wonder like if there's some sort of like podcasting or
I don't know. I hope that we retain both, that the internet can give us new possibilities that we
yeah.
haven't had before, but I love traditional books too. I love the feel of books in my hand, and I hope that doesn't ever get replaced.
Yeah. It's not as easy to read, I don't find, like from a screen or from
mm-hmm. I find the same thing too. When I'm editing my own work, I often have to print it out. There's
yeah.
something just very different about having the page, the manuscript in my hands versus having it on
yeah.
the screen. So same words, oftentimes in the desktop at home, I can see the full page there, but it's having it as a physical, tangible product you can hold on to me nice. And there's such a rich history with publishing and printmaking too that I think that's something we should hold on to as well.
Mark's a printmaker.
Yeah, I remember you saying that too. Yeah. Again, one of my other interests is in book history too.
Mm-hmm.
History of book production and manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Well, thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.
And it's great to hear your work and get to know you a little better. And yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. We had a few listeners who, while you were assuming to put on some music for a few minutes and eat some food, because I've been, yeah, you can see IP addresses.
Oh, cool.
But somebody just logged off. I have a feeling it was probably your husband.
Probably. Are you going to archive it? You can sit on me if you want.
Why?
Well, if you want, you don't have to. Why not?
I like the windows on there.
It's
so neat.
Why?
Because it's beautiful to have windows within a building. It just looks like you can be in one space and in another space.
Hey, Dan, what's this here in the kitchen for?
We shot the tiger on the
road.
In the field behind the cages, you walk in circles.
Like a gambling lens, and I am a breathless soul for you. And the red-breasted robin beat his wings as road trembles when he sings, for he's a helpless pitbull. And the happy hood to bells bow, and the bend of the heads all a down. A heavy by the early morning dew, at the whispering serene, at the bubbling broth, the fish is deep up to take a look. For they are breathless over you. Still your hands, still your heart, still your face comes shining through. And all the morning goes in you. Still your mind, still your soul, still the fire of a lover's dream. And I am a breathless without you. Circles among the trees, and it bangs about of the new-made leaves. Oh, it is a breathless without you. And the fox chases the rabbit around, and the rabbit hides beneath the ground. For it is defenseless without you. The sky it takes on dies away, and all the earthly things they stop to play. For we are all breathless without you. I listen to my jordering bones and the blood in my veins, the wind in my lungs. And I am a breathless without you. Still your hands, still your heart, still your face comes shining through. And all the morning goes in you. Still your soul, still your mind, still the fire of my love is true. And I am a breathless without you.
Thank you. Somebody's baby boy ain't coming home. Need a